All right. Well, good morning, everybody. This side is outweighing that side pretty dramatically. Welcome here. And I'm going to start today. My message, if you were here maybe 2 months ago, I did a message about, well, you know, what's the purpose of church? Why are we doing church? This is going to be, I thought, well, maybe is it a part two, but it's almost like a prequel to it. It's not entirely. You don't need to have heard that one to hear this one. But some of you might say, well, that sounds like they're a little related. So they are related. Topic a lot on my mind. Maybe a lot of topic on your mind. But before we jump into that, I want to start with a story. Because otherwise you'd be bored and you wouldn't listen. So let's start with a story. Now, this is a story that I used in a sermonette maybe 7 years ago. So some of you will say, oh, I remember that. And it's also, maybe you know the story not from me, because it's a true story. But it was made famous by a very popular book that came out in 2008 called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, which is actually a really interesting book. I recommend reading that if you get a chance. There's a lot of interesting things in there. This was, I think, chapter one. True story. The story is titled The Rosetto Mystery. The Rosetto Mystery. So does anybody know this from Outliers or remember 7 years ago? Sometimes I say, Sabrina, they're going to, you know, everybody remember that. And she's like, not everybody's that. Not everybody's making notes quite like that. Anybody know the story? All right, new. It's going to be a new story. The Rosetto Mystery. Everybody likes a mystery, right? So we're going to talk about Italian immigrants. And anymore, I mean, there's nothing in here that I think is offensive at all, right? But maybe I generalize a little bit. So Skip, please don't be offended. Anybody else who's got Italian roots, I don't think there's anything offensive in here. But we're going to talk about a town in Italy called Rosetto, Italy. For centuries, this town existed, and the people pretty much did the same thing. They worked in the marble quarries in the surrounding hills. They would walk 4 or 5 miles from their little town down to the marble quarries, down the mountain in the morning, and then making the long journey back up the hill at night. For centuries. It was a hard life. The townsfolk were barely literate, and they were desperately poor. And without much hope for economic betterment. Until one day, word reached Rosetto. This is around the end of the 19th century. Word reached Rosetto about the land of opportunity across the ocean. So in the 1880s, immigrants from Rosetto, Italy, settled into a small town in eastern Pennsylvania, which they also named Rosetto. And it's still there. You can look on your map. Rosetto, Pennsylvania still exists. My brother lives like 30 minutes from there. I've never visited it, but it's kind of a dot on the map. It's not a very big town, and it's not real famous, except for the story I'm about to tell you. Well, in the late 1890s, the town came to life. The Rosettans began raising animals in their backyard and growing grapes for homemade wine. Schools and a park and a church and a cemetery were built. Small shops and bakeries and restaurants and bars opened. And more than a dozen factories sprang up. A lot of the factories were used in the garment trade, making blouses in the garment trade. Rosetto, Pennsylvania was just like its own little tiny self-sufficient world, all but unknown by the society around it. And it probably would have remained that way, except for a chance encounter one day between a medical researcher, who was a famous medical researcher, who was meeting an old friend who was a doctor that lived in the general eastern Pennsylvania area. They met for lunch one day. They were old friends and over drinks, and they were just discussing what was going on. The researcher was talking about his work. The doctor was talking about his work. And, you know, the doctor said, you know, I've been practicing medicine for 17 years, and I get patients from all over eastern Pennsylvania. There's this one little town no one from that town under the age of 65 has heart disease. The researcher was skeptical. I mean, this was the 1950s. This was before even cholesterol medication, all the stuff that supposedly at least has helped heart disease. And, you know, all the knowledge of trying to be aggressive about diet and exercise to prevent it. In 1950s, heart attacks were an absolute epidemic in the United States. It was the number one killer. It was the leading cause of death in men under the age of 65. It was impossible to be a doctor, common sense said, and not see heart disease. So the researcher decided he was going to research this. And he and his team descended on Rosetto. and they performed a major multi-year study with every person over the age of 22 in the town. And indeed, the results were mind-blowing. In Roseto, virtually no one under the age of 55 died of a heart attack or showed any signs of heart disease. Nobody. And for men over 65, the death rate from heart disease in Roseto was half of that in the United States. In fact, the death rate from all causes in Roseto, in fact, was something like 30 or 35% lower than it should have been. The medical researcher was baffled. There was no suicide, no alcoholism, no drug addiction, and very little crime. They didn't have anyone on welfare. And we looked at peptic ulcers. They didn't have any of those either. These people were dying of old age. That's it. They died of old age. So the researchers started to hypothesize. First they said, aha, it's the diet. They must have some dietary practices from the old world. It's the Mediterranean diet. That's what's keeping them going. But he quickly realized that wasn't true. I mean, he was spending months in this town. He was watching these people. These Italians ate all the traditional Italian food. They were not eating what we would consider today a wildly healthy diet. The researcher, his name was Wolf, when he had his dietitians actually analyze the typical Rosettans' eating habits, he found that a whopping 41% of their calories came from fat. They were not eating just, you know, all the things that today we'd say are the things you should be eating. Nor was this a town where people got up at dawn to do yoga or run a brisk 6 miles. No, the Pennsylvania Rosettans smoked heavily, and many were struggling with obesity. Well, if it wasn't diet and exercise, then it must be genetics. These people have some kind of magical genetic thing that they carried over from, you know, because they'd lived for centuries in the same town. You know, the Rosettans were a close-knit group from the same region. And the researcher, Wolf, said, next thought, they must have some kind of special genetics, hardy stock, that protected them from disease. So he could study this, because he could find Rosettans that immigrated other places in the United States. They didn't all go to that town. And he did. He went and sought them out. But their health statistics looked almost exactly like the rest of the United States, not like the town of Roseto. So it's not the genetics. Then he thought, maybe there's something in the water, right? Maybe it's something about that area. Maybe it's the region where the Rosettans live. Was it possible there's something about living in the foothills of eastern Pennsylvania that was good for your health? Well, there were two towns just down the road from Roseto. One was Bangor, which was just down the hill, and Nazareth, a few miles away. These were both about the same size as Roseto and populated with the same kind of hardworking European immigrants. So Wolf, the researcher, combed through both towns' medical records. For men over 65, the death rates from heart disease in Nazareth and Bangor were something like 3 times that of Roseto. It was yet another dead end. So what was it? The mystery of Roseto. Again, this guy went to this town and lived for a long time, studying it. And what he slowly began to realize was that the secret of Roseto wasn't diet, it wasn't exercise, it wasn't genes, it wasn't the region. It had to be the town itself. And as the researchers lived there and walked around town every day, they began to realize why. They looked at how the Rosettans visited each other, stopping to chat with each other in Italian. They were still speaking Italian on the street, or cooking for each other in their backyards. They learned that the families kind of lived together. And some people in our congregation could probably heavily relate to that, where the clans kind of stick together in their homes and still live together. That really was the foundation of the town's social structure. They saw how many homes had 3 generations living under roof and how much respect grandparents commanded. They went to church together, and they saw the unifying and calming effect of all going to church together. They counted 22 separate civic organizations in a town of just 2,000 people. And they picked up on the particular egalitarian ethos of the town that discouraged the wealthy from acting like they were wealthy and helped the unsuccessful obscure their failures. And they came to a remarkable conclusion for a scientific study to come to. In the end, researchers concluded that the Rosetta effect had no medical or physical explanation. Rosettans were nourished by people. In all ways, this happy result was exactly the opposite expectation of well-proven health laws. And that is a quote from the researchers. Here's what one of the researchers said. I remember going to Rosetta for the first time, and you'd see three generational family meals. All the bakeries, the people walking up and down the street and sitting on their porches talking to each other, the blouse mills where the women worked during the day while the men worked in the slate quarries. It was magical. When researchers first presented their findings to the medical community, you can imagine the kind of skepticism that they faced. They went to conferences where their peers were presenting long rows of data, you know, arrayed in complex charts and referring to this kind of gene or that kind of physiological process, and they were talking instead about this mysterious and magical benefits of people stopping to talk to each other on the street and having three generations living under one roof. Living a long life, the conventional wisdom said at the time, depended to a great extent on who we were. That is, our genes. And it depended on the decisions we made, on what we chose to eat, or how much we chose to exercise, or how effectively the medical system treated us. That's the conventional wisdom at the time. It still is today, by the way. No one was used to thinking about health in these terms. That people could actually nourish other people. Now, I love stories like this. And one reason why is, you know, and I'll say this to young people, this world will try to tell you that all you are is merely a physical being. All you are is the sum of your molecules that can all be looked under a microscope. That's all you are. And science has looked at everything and can explain the physical by the physical. That is gospel truth in this day and age. That's what almost everybody you're going to face seems to believe. And that's one reason I love stories like this. Because even science has proven over and over again that the physical sometimes just can't be explained by the physical. That there are strange mysteries of how the spiritual, even if it's the human spirit, something you can't touch or see or inspect under a microscope, has powerful effects on the physical. This was a medical study. This isn't some funded by some group that has an interest. These people were motivated not to find this stuff. But my purpose today is not science versus religion. I love that topic. That's just an aside. Rather, my purpose is simple. My purpose is simply to get you thinking today about the power of people to nourish other people. The power of community. The power of the human spirit mixed with the Holy Spirit. And you might say, Ben, you kind of talked about this once or twice before. I just think in the last year and a half, maybe somebody seems to have forgotten this. That people can nourish other people. And that community is important. And it's something to be valued, to be around other people. And my purpose today is to inspire you, every one of you, to look at yourselves, to examine yourself. I'm saying this to me too. To recognize within yourself both the need and desire for deep connections with other people. And act on it. That's the purpose. God tells us he looks at our heart. You know, in the Bible, the book that we look at every week, it talks about the heart really more than any part of man. You know, the heart is like the symbol. The Bible uses it as the symbol of our true being, our true spirit. Because we're not just the physical shell we're in. The heart's like the metaphor for who we really deep down are, what our character is, who our spiritual being is. And so today I want to show you the connection and the symbolism between what's scientifically good for your physical heart and people nourishing people, and then the spiritual parallels. my goal is to get you to answer this question. How can I in my life, how can you in your life, how can we exercise the power of people to nourish people? And we're going to talk about two very basic areas. This is not going to be rocket science. There is nothing here I'm going to say you've never heard before. The reason I'm talking about it is because I think, like I said, we as like a common man seem to have forgotten this in the last year and a half. And if we haven't forgotten it, we're not acting on it. Two areas we're going to talk about. Family and the community of believers. Two areas where we can practice people nourishing people. And we can each act on it. And when we look at these two areas, I'm going to ask you to write down three goals. And you don't have to do it in the service, because I actually want you to think about them maybe a little bit more. But I want your homework to be three goals in each of these areas. And we'll get into a little more detail. Three goals in each of these areas. What can you do? And I want you to commit to doing it. Tell somebody so they hold you accountable. So the first area is family. Family. Your family. For the Rosettans, family was everything. Families were close, and multiple generations all lived within the same home. Families were self-sufficient, and families took care of their own. Indeed, there have been countless studies in the medical literature supporting the fact that strong marriage, strong family relationships can protect us from heart attacks and give us longer physical life. It's not just this Rosetto mystery. You know, you've probably heard me or someone else maybe, because this one gets mentioned a lot. It's the most famous social science study ever done in the world is a study called the Harvard Grant Study. I mentioned this on a previous sermon. You can go look it up. It is the authority on social science the world has ever done. The Harvard Grant Study tried to capture people's thoughts, and over, it went over 70 years, it studied hundreds of men. Over and over again, they wanted to see what people's thoughts were and how it affected their health. And over again, these bonds of human relationship, particularly within the family, were described, and their correlation to the human outcome was more powerful than anything else in the study. The number one correlation between health was not diet, it was not exercise, it was not genes. Just like the Rosetto study, it was relationships with other people. Not physical, measuring physical. What determines the longevity of a life of a man at 50 more? They looked at this. Was it his cholesterol levels or deep quality relationships? It was not even close. The number one determinant of death in this study of these hundreds of men, the number one determinant of death before the average age in this study, this is what the science concluded. You know what it was? Loneliness. The power of the bonds of one human to another that can only be determined in a scientific study by the language to describe these bonds actually had more power over the physical existence of man than any other physical item. Go figure. You know, it's unbelievable, really, right? It's unbelievable. Yet amazingly consistent with what God told us thousands of years before modern science. You don't need to turn there. I think you all will know this. Exodus 20 and verse 12, the fifth commandment. Honor your father and mother, and then you will live a long, full life in the land your Lord is giving you. Family is so important to God that throughout the Bible, God gives us the metaphor of family to describe his relationship to us. He uses that more than anything else. Why does he do that? Why does he do that? It's also important in how he describes the future will be. And it's so important that he places each and every human that's ever lived in a physical family, in this life. And yeah, I know it doesn't always work out. You know, there's adoption, there's stuff that happens. But as you go through life, you choose family, or family chooses you. You end up in a family. And if you don't, it's very, very sad. But most humans, God places in a family and they get that experience. And why does he do that? Why is that a shared experience of almost every human being? Because it's how we can learn to be like him and how we can learn about how we're supposed to be and how we can build our eternal character. There's actually probably no greater place where we both learn and demonstrate and grow our spiritual character than within our family. How close-knit is your family? Do you nourish each other? Do you practice the very basics of the Bible every day in the simplest form that God has given us, our families? Now, maybe your family doesn't live near you, but in this day and age, I think we can connect with tools. Anybody do that recently? You don't have an excuse. We can still connect with our family more than we could, at least in the past. But maybe your family's still right with you, kind of nearly every day you see each other. One of the greatest blessings God gave to every human is family. And that sounds really good, mom and apple pie, but it's not that simple. Having close, healthy families is not simple. It may be one of the hardest things God gives us to do. It's complex, it's messy, it's hard work every hour of every day. And there is family sabotage everywhere you look. I'm going to talk about three major reasons why families fall apart or just aren't close or just aren't nourishing each other. Three family sabotages. I'm going to talk about those in a little detail, and then I'm going to give you an antidote to each one of them. Now, in 2021, I probably could have added a fourth emerging issue, which is just the utter societal mass confusion about what gender and family even means. But that's a whole other topic. I'm not going to talk about that sabotage. That sabotage is emerging. But the other three have been around a long time, and all three of them, everybody's dealt with in their family. And everybody might be dealing with all three of them right now, maybe in some shape or form. So let's look at these three family sabotages and what the antidote is. First one is very basic. Biggest sabotage of family is sin. From the very beginning in Eden, the best tool Satan has at sabotaging man is sin. And there is no better way for you to burn your family to the ground than to sin. Two of the Ten Commandments are entirely related to the family. Honor your father and mother. Do not commit adultery. Those are entirely around the family. And then there are five more that I would argue very much refer to the family. We'll talk about those a little bit. Said another way, 20% of the Ten Commandments are entirely about family, and 70% of the Ten Commandments are generally referenced around what we would experience within the family. If you destroy your marriage by adultery or abuse, or if you disrespect your parents and treat them with dishonor, or if you hate someone in your family, or you steal from them, or lie about them, or jealously covet what they have, if you do any of those sins, you are injecting poison into your family. And that poison can only be blunted by God's intervention after deep repentance, change, and unfortunately, time. What is the antidote to this sabotage? This question should be easy. But it's simply said, but difficult to do. Don't sin. Obey God's laws. He gave them to us for our own good. And they're not, I make it sound like, oh, this is just, you know, check the boxes every day. It is hard work. I completely acknowledge that. Because I completely experience it. The antidote is don't sin. Walk in God's commandments. But here's the thing I want you to think about. Sin doesn't normally happen kind of like all all of a sudden, all on its own. Usually not. It's usually not in a nanosecond. No, as Jesus tells us, and as the Bible refers to it as leaven, it starts very small, usually. It starts in our hearts and our thoughts. That's where the sin, almost all the sin I just talked about, where it starts. That's where it starts, and before it becomes action. So the real antidote here, the real antidote to the sabotage, is to stop and pause. And think about, as you are dealing with your family, your husband or wife, your kids, your siblings, your parents, are there little things of conflict? Do you just start looking at them where you're just annoyed with them? Kind of almost bordering on anger. Little signs of just not wanting to be around them. Those are the seeds. Sin hasn't happened yet, but it's starting to grow. You need to analyze that and diagnose it before those little bits of leaven grow and expand and turn into full-blown sin. That is the antidote in your family relationships to not letting sin sabotage it. Remember this. Sin will poison your family. Stay away from it. God has told us this for our own good. The second one, this is a little along the same lines, but the second sabotage to family is the past. It's the past hurts and offenses. Now, some of these may be caused by sin, but many may not be overt sin. They would be debatable. This family sabotage, it's a lot less like poison. It's not as much like poison. It's more like an open wound that just won't heal. Or it's like a wall that you just can't scale it. I'm willing to bet that as each of you sit here, and I don't know, I'm guessing 80, 90% of everybody in this room has this somewhere in their family. It's someone important in their family, someone who genuinely hurt you in ways that you feel maybe they can never be repaired or healed. And I'm not downplaying it all, because I think what can feel like family betrayal or ice-cold family love or lack of love, you know, that may be some of the greatest pain humans feel. But if you're in that spot, the family is being sabotaged. There's a wall blocking you from ever enjoying and participating in the nourishing of the family, the nourishing of each other. So what is the antidote? Well, unlike number one, I don't know that this antidote is 100%. Because in this case, there are two involved. And you can't always solve every one of the problems. I get that. But maybe it's about 75% effective, and I'd say it's worth it for 75% effective. And that antidote is forgiveness. Forgiveness. Let me read a few scriptures to that. You don't need to turn there, because I'm going to go relatively fast, but there's a lot of scriptures that talk about forgiveness. Proverbs 17 and verse 9, it says, "Love prospers when a fault is forgiven, but dwelling on it separates close friends." Very simple proverb that's so true. Matthew 18, verses 21 through 22, Peter came to Jesus and said, "Lord, how often should I forgive someone who sins against me?" And this can go for family too. His response didn't say, well, for family's one thing and everybody else is another. Seven times, Peter asked? Jesus said, no, not seven times, but 70 times seven. Why would Jesus say that? Colossians 3 and verse 13. Paul writes, "Bear with each other and forgive one another if any of you has a grievance against someone. Forgive as the Lord forgave you." And we know we have all sinned thousands of times. more than 70 times 7, which sounds ridiculously a lot. But all of us are going to go and ask for God's forgiveness more than that, and he's going to grant it to us if we repent. Why should you forgive your family member who's done you wrong? Because you owe it to them? No. Because you owe it to God. Ephesians 4 in verses 31 and 32. Paul writes, get rid of all bitterness. And that's a lot of times what those feelings can turn into. Bitterness. Get rid of all bitterness, rage, and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. Are there walls up sabotaging your family? Well, this is a hard ask. Some of you will say, I just can't do it. I'm not in your shoes, so I'm not really going to judge that. But if you're willing, I ask you to try this. Try to forgive. Try to forgive. Pray to God and ask him to give you the ability to forgive. It's beyond you. Ask him for the help. Work to give yourself peace and to let it go. You be the one who takes the initiative to humbly put it in God's hands, to deeply, in your heart, forgive their trespasses. And again, not because you owe it to them, because you owe it to God, who has forgiven all of your shortcomings. And if you do this in doing so, perhaps the antidote will be effective. Perhaps the wound can heal and the wall can be torn down and family nourishment can be restored. The third sabotage of family, and there's probably more, these are just the three I found. The third is time. The antidote is also time. Do you make time for your family? You make time, and the truth of it is, when all of it comes down at the end of the day, you make time for what you value. Do you make time for your family? Or is every minute of every day gobbled up by work, school, sports, activities, your phone, YouTube, or whatever other time vacuum sucks up all your day and all your energy? Now, I mentioned that 7 of the 10 commandments referred to the family in some way, and some of you might have been doing the math and said, Ben got that wrong. He meant 6. No, I mean 7. Because you know, the Sabbath has a family element to it. People will laugh at us about the Sabbath like it's some sort of like medieval Dark Ages concept. But I'll tell you what, in my own personal life, the Sabbath has been one of the biggest blessings to knowing, reconnecting, building, pausing, and savoring family. It's like this hidden silver lining in it. Why? Because God gives us a pause on the Sabbath. He gives us time to pause and reflect on the most important things. So if you're sitting there saying, Ben, I really want to do better at nourishing my family, but I don't know where to start. Start with the time that God grants you generously. You know, this day in this world is our declaration of independence from the slavery of this world and the dominance over our lives through sucking up all our time. It's a weekly Sabbath. You can start and nourish your family, at least on the Sabbath. You can do that. We're all here, I think, because we all value the Sabbath. And we can use that time to obviously draw close to God and worship him, no doubt about it. But the silver lining of nourishing your family can go along with it. Start there. Start there and then build out from there. Have dinner together. Play games. Do karaoke. Talk about God and the Bible. Share the important things with each other. Ask questions, be interested, share, give, serve each other, nourish each other. Tell them you love them. Give them your time. Be there when they need it the most. Hug them. You know, practice every part of your Christian walk and your growing spiritual being within your family. So now every one of you gets an assignment. I told you the assignment was coming. You don't have to do it right now, but you have to do it. Somebody who knows you should be checking on you. Check on each other. I want you to think about it. I want you to each write down three goals on what you can do, what you can change, what you can act on to better nourish your family in the year ahead. In the year ahead. Perhaps it's stopping the seed of sin you kind of know is there. Perhaps it's forgiving a close family member who hurts you deeply. Maybe it's an idea on how you can use your time to draw closer. And even if you have a tight-knit family, there are surely simple ways you can bond even more deeply. And I want you to commit to following through on those three goals. Remember, it's for your own health. It's for your own good. But even more importantly than that, your character within your family, how you think and how you act and how you operate, it's who you are becoming as a spiritual being. It's not really about now. The most part is not about now, the temporary. What God is really doing is he's incubating your eternal future being. He's incubating your eternal future being, and he's doing that right now in your families. Which leads me to the second area, because he's also doing it there. And I'm looking at my battery power because it's about dead, so I may need to switch to my phone. There's a second incubator God is using to grow spiritual character. Anybody guess what that is? It's one that's very similar to family, because simply put, it's your spiritual family. How can we, and I mean local congregation, I mean national, global, I mean Church of God, I mean community of believers, ecclesia, how can we, the body of Christ, how can we use the power of people to nourish people? And why? Does it matter? Does God care? Let's see if God cares. We should start there because I think it's a good reminder after the last year and a half that God cares about this. It's a good reminder to me. It's a good reminder to all of you. All of us have been a little infected by this. Does it really matter to be a community? You know, we read a lot at the Passover in John. You know, Jesus' prayer right before he's crucified. We get chapters of that. We read it at the Passover every year. I want to read a little bit of that. But I want to point out one very important thing you all know and have heard. Does it matter? Does it matter? How will anyone know who is the church? John 13, 34, 35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another. Does God care about the community of believers nourishing each other? He says it's going to be how people will know. Let's read a little bit more because I want you to get the flavor of does God care about this? God in the flesh, Jesus Christ, before he was crucified, what did he have on his mind? John 17. Turn there because I'm going to go ahead and read it. I'm going to read it in the New Living Translation because a lot of you have read this over and over again in the same words, and sometimes you just don't get the effect. God in the flesh, Jesus Christ, was here. He had feelings. This is what was on his mind and what he felt and was expressing to God in prayer right before his crucifixion. John 17, and I'm going to start in verse 9. I'm going to read the rest of the chapter. My prayer is not for the world, God, but for those you have given me. They belong to you. That does mean the community of believers today. He's going to say that later. All who are mine belong to you, and you've given them to me, so they bring me glory. Now I am departing from the world. They are staying in the world, but I am coming to you. Holy Father, you have given me your name. Now protect them by the power of your name so that they will be united just as we are. During my time here, I protected them by the power of the name you gave me. I guarded them so that not one was lost except for the one headed for destruction, as the scriptures foretold. Now I am coming to you. I told them many things while I was with them in the world so they would be filled with my joy. I have given them your word, and the world hates them, because they do not belong to the world, just as I do not belong to the world. I'm not asking to take them out of the world, but to keep them safe from the evil one. They do not belong to this world any more than I do. Make them holy by your truth. Teach them your word, which is truth, just as you sent me into the world. I am sending them into the world, and I give myself as a holy sacrifice for them so they can be made holy by your truth. I'm reading kind of all this, and you might say, well, some of it doesn't. This is what's important to Jesus, and he's expressing to God at the very end. And I'm praying not only for these disciples, but for all of those who will ever believe in me through their message. He was including you in this prayer. I pray that they will all be one just as you and I are one, as you are in me, Father, and I am in you, and may they be in us. Why? So that the world will believe that you sent me. How we treat each other is going to be what people say is right or not. Why do you think a lot of people blast Christianity today? Because Christianity started wars, fought each other, divided up families. And then people say, we don't believe in God. Jesus is saying that here. I have given them the glory you gave me so they may be one as we are one. I am in them and you are in me. May they experience such perfect unity that the world will know that you sent me and that you love them as much as you love me. Father, I want these whom you've given me to be with me where I am. He wants all of us in his kingdom. Then they can see all the glory you gave me because you loved me before even the world began. O righteous Father, the world doesn't know you, but I do. And these disciples know you sent me. I have revealed you to them, and I will continue to do so. Then your love for me will be in them, and I will be in them. Does it matter to God on how what we as a community of believers do in becoming together? Does God care? Does he care about how we feel about one another? How we nourish each other? I would argue it's what God cares about almost as much as anything else. Why does he care? Well, Jesus told you a bunch of reasons right there. But right now, right here and right now, God is building his eternal family. He's starting to build the kingdom of God. And sometimes we think, oh, that's going to all be in the future. Yeah, the kingdom is in the future, but the character and the connections that we have are starting to be built now. We read in Acts quite a bit. A couple months ago, right around Pentecost, the message I told you was kind of a sequel to this. Read a lot about that. And it's just, you just read it over and over again about that was so important to the first church, the early church. And over again, Paul stresses the need for the church to love one another, to bond as a community, and to serve each other. I'll read some of these here. Because I want to remind myself how important this is. Romans, you don't need to turn these, I'll just go through them. Romans 12 and verse 4 through 5. For as in one body we have many members, and the members do not all have the same function, so we, though many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. We're connected. Hebrews 10 and verses 24 through 25. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another. And all the more as you see the day drawing near. It's almost like Paul's saying there, nourish each other. People nourish people in the church. And it's really hard to do that if you never get together. Galatians 6 and verse 2. Bear one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 14. And we urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, and be patient with them all. With all the community. I could probably read half the New Testament. This is basic stuff, but it's stuff that does take effort. It takes effort. Big time effort. It takes time. But you know what it really takes? You know what it really takes? It takes that we value it. It takes that we value it. Now we have our, because you got to put your whole heart into it. I'm not saying this to like make anybody like feel embarrassed or ashamed talking about, you know, community, and we think, well, maybe we're not doing as good. I'm not doing as good. This is not about that, but this is about trying to inspire you to value it. If you don't want to, if you're not interested and enthused about being part of the community, I'm not trying to make you feel ashamed. You've got to want to be a part of it. You've got to want it badly. You know, what has happened in the last year and a half has done as much to destroy our bonds and church community, at least in my lifetime, as any split has ever done. Some of you may not agree with that. A couple things people probably won't agree with me here, but I'm going to say them because it's my observation and why I think it's important. You know, it's different this time than a lot of the things we've experienced where our churches divide and split. It's different this time. It's not as overt. It's more subtle. But we are now infected by the thinking that we don't necessarily need the community. We don't need the community. I'm going to admit that I have thought that some. Because you've kind of gone without it for a year and a half. And, well, we're all, you know, okay, well, yeah, we can do it this way. Maybe I don't need community. The world around us in the last year has hoodwinked us. Hoodwinked us into thinking we don't need to nourish people. We don't need nourished by people. And as a community of believers, it doesn't really matter if we get together physically or spend time together. There's so many subtle ways that's just it's blaring in our ears and our minds all the time. Now, you don't believe me. Some people are saying, Ben, come on. Look at our attendance here. I'm not trying to make anybody feel bad. This is about making choices and values and stuff like that. Inspect yourself in your own thinking. Like I said, I'm going to admit it. I've been infected by this thinking some. I think we all, how can we not be to some degree? But it's okay. We're here now. We know it. What are we going to do about it? And I'll say, like I said, no one is saying it, but I'm going to say it. I think we have hit a silent crisis in the church. I don't mean Raleigh. I really think we've hit a silent crisis in the church. And if we don't get back to being, a true community of believers here and around the world and in the community of believers that exist as a church, I just think we're not going in the right direction. Let me ask you a question. We talked about this in the message I gave 2 months ago, but I want to ask you a question. And I want you to answer this question truthfully. Truthfully in your heart of hearts. Do you love the church? And not just saying it. But really, do you love it? I am not trying to tell you, I'm not preaching about any church or anything like that. I'm not preaching put your love of church ahead of God, none of that. God is the most important relationship, there's no doubt about it. And that's being attacked too. I'm just trying to focus on the message here though, about being a community. We read all the scriptures and how important it is, how it was on Jesus' mind right before he was crucified. Because if you don't really love it, let's be honest, if your heart's not in it, and we can say whatever we want. It just won't matter. It just won't matter. Because we are here as a community of believers by God's call. But then our heart's commitment to love him back and love the community of believers he's calling, right? That's part of our part in it. We just read a bunch of scriptures about that. So let me ask you again, do you love the church? I have to ask myself this question because I'll give you my answer here. But I need to stay focused on my answer. Because I can get distracted, probably like a lot of you. Maybe a lot of you are in the same boat I am in, that you feel this way, but are you valuing it? Are you prioritizing it? Is it important? Do you think about it a lot? I gave you this a couple months ago, same thing. I'll just repeat the same thing. I love this church. It's not perfect by any means, and I don't mean United. I love this church. We've been given the truth. We have relative peace, at least from overt division and attack. We have a global work that tries to fulfill the Great Commission and that is aligned with what God has asked his apostles to do. A global work that also allows the local area to do stuff. We have the incredible blessing of every week having the laws of God and the model of Jesus preached to us. We can come and worship every week. I love that. We have a pastor who works very hard to be in the Word, to try to expound on and explain it and be there for us when we need support. We have a family, church family right here and broader. A lot of you have big church family. I don't mean related, but it's really your family that support us who genuinely care and are there when you need someone the most. You know, people that when you're sick, they're there. When life beats you down, they're there to pick you up. I've mentioned this before, but I've gone to a lot of funerals. You know, when you're at these funerals and I look around, half the people there are the church. They're there for you. So I know I'm focusing a little on the negative, but there's a lot to love. But have we forgotten about it? We're not a perfect church family. Sometimes we're all too busy. Sometimes we're all too human. I know we can all be better. But I love the memories I have of this church. The Sabbath services, feasts, camps, activities, service projects, fellowshipping, visits, and even trials. Some of the best parts, if not the best parts, of my life. Maybe yours too. Maybe yours too, but maybe you haven't thought about it as much recently. The truth is, I've taken the church for granted at times. And again, when I say the church, I mean the community of all of us, the community of the bigger church community that believe similarly and want to follow God. I've taken it for granted at times. And yeah, even in the last year and a half. But you got to start with the question. Do you value it? Do you love it? Do you want it? And then you can, if the answer is yes, then you can start to take action. So what can we do? What can we do? Well, in the Rosetto community, what struck researchers and made the light bulb actually go off for them was how they lived each day. It's how they made time to chat together, how they constantly shared food with each other, how they spent their free time in community service, or how they celebrated festivals together, how they worshiped as one, and how they took care of their own. That sense of belonging, that sense of being supported, that sense of being something bigger than your individual self, the love of one another, it actually had a magical effect on one particular human organ, the heart. Do you want a spiritually healthy heart? Do we as a church want a spiritually healthy heart? There is no better way than to nourish the brotherhood here and beyond, to nourish each other. If you don't like the example of Rosetto that I just gave you, that's fine. Like we did 2 months ago, go back and read the book of Acts, because it actually sounds quite similar. People spent time together, servicing together, went to church together, kept festivals together, ate meals with each other, shared what they had with each other. That's what God gives us as the model of the church. And the believers then, they were invested, they were on fire. They shared all things, their love for one another and their community. It was palpable. You can still read about it 2,000 years later in pages written down and feel how palpable that sense of community was in Acts. And they were fulfilling Jesus' words, that by this shall all men know who you are, by how you love one another. They were doing that. And each person here, let's forget all the past year and a half. Don't feel bad about it. Don't worry about it. Just start asking yourself the question, do you really love and value the church, the community of believers? Let's start that now. Because there's opportunity. There's so much, including myself, there's so much that each of us can do to build a stronger community. There's so much that we can do starting now to nourish one another. So let's just start with a clean slate now. What is it that you will do in the coming year? What are 3 things you will commit to? Maybe it's to become more engaged here at services. Maybe it's to be at services in person on a regular basis. Maybe it's to fellowship more here at services and in each other's homes or on the phone. Maybe it's to have more people over your house, practice hospitality. Maybe it's to write notes of caring or make phone calls during the week. Maybe it's to be there when people are going through trials, that we haven't been there for them, or we hear about it and we pray for them, which is important. Maybe there's more we can do. I can raise my hand to like all these. Maybe it's to start planning socials. Maybe it's to be there to share the joys with one another. That's something maybe we don't do enough. People have a lot of good things going on, and we don't celebrate it as much as we should with each other. Ponder on it. Pray about it. Meditate on it. Make 3 goals. Write them down. And then work every week, day by day, to follow through on it. 3 on your family, 3 on your church family. We, as a church, in my opinion, are at a crossroads. And let's be clear. There is no way we as a church will grow. No way. There is no way we as individuals or as a church will have a healthy spiritual heart if we don't follow through on this. So whatever happened with Rosetto, you might ask? Close up by telling you the story, the rest of the story. In 1963, remember this was in the 50s, in 1963, these investigators made a prescient observation. They made a prediction. They believed that as Rosettans became more Americanized, meaning less close, less modest, and less interdependent, they would also become less healthy. The wearing off of the now famous Rosetto effect would be apparent within a generation. They predicted that that would happen. And unfortunately, so it was. In the slate quarries and blouse factories, the men and women of Rosetto, they labored hard to be able to send their children to go to college, which they did. They did. They did it at a rate far above the national average. By World War II, Rosetto had a small white-collar class. It started then and was prospering. And of course, with that, life began to change. The groundbreaking study took place just as Rosetto's golden age of community was drawing to a close. They were able to predict that the Rosettans then under 30 would not long be content with their rigid, traditional lifestyle. And by the 70s, homes on the outskirts of town were in the suburbanized style that had become the American norm. Large single-family houses, swimming pools, fenced yards, country clubs, and churches outside the community. As people moved and achieved material success, they found those gains at the expense of traditional communal values, which they had been raised. One person who grew up in Rosetto and later reflected said, "I'm sorry we moved. I'm sorry we moved. Everything is modern here, and we have everything I need here, except people." The principal of the elementary school said the children's lives changed. They went from days filled with activities to lives watching from the sidelines. She found she had to teach children how to play jacks and marbles. The strongest evidence that change had come to Rosetto was in 1985, when the town's cornet band, founded in 1890, demanded for the first time to be paid for playing at the church's big festival. As Wolf, the researcher, and his colleagues continued to monitor the health of the community, they kept studying them. They noted that social change in the village was accompanied by increasing health problems. In 1971, the first heart attack death of a person less than 45 occurred in Rosetto. In a 1992 study, it was confirmed that the rate of heart attack in Rosetto was now at or above the national average. All good things in this human world come to an end. So it was with Rosetto. The power of the human spirit eventually was overcome by the ways of this world. But it left us with a powerful lesson. And that is that the power of people to nourish other people is real and it's significant. That the very basics that God gives us in his second great command actually has a magical positive effect on our most symbolic organ spiritually, our heart. So, as I wrap up today, let's not focus on feeling bad or worrying about the past. We're starting new. Each of us walks out of here today with the power to strengthen our hearts by committing ourselves to nourish others, to value people and being with people and nourishing them, connecting with them, not only with our human spirit, but with the power of God's Holy Spirit within us. We need to commit ourselves to practice this first in our families. The incubator. We need to guard our precious families by obeying God and putting out sin, by forgiving the hurts of the past and giving ourselves peace and healing within the family. And we need to give our family time and energy and hearts and love. God is incubating us for eternity here in our family. And finally, we have the opportunity in the church as a community of believers. We even have the opportunity right here in this congregation to create a spiritual Rosetto. You know, a case study on how people can nourish people God's way. We have to do this. We have to do this. It's not a nice to have or a suggestion. It's what God told us was part of our commission and how people would know we were his community of believers. So let us commit to our brothers. Let's commit to it today and rebuild our community on the foundation of love, so that we can look back not far from now and really confidently say, and by this shall all men know that we are his disciples because we have love one another.